history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, pretty incredible stories, stories that will get your attention, that may even inspire you. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we really are educated, we're entertained, and yeah, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada with 94-year-old Roger Bain, originally from northern Wisconsin. What's your hometown in Wisconsin, Roger?
Rhinelander, Wisconsin. It's north central. It'd be north of Wausau. 40 miles. It's only 8 or 9,000 people. They had a big paper mill there. Of course, that's timber country. It's always been.
And a fair amount of snow in the winter, I imagine.
And cold weather. Yeah. I seen 40 below up there.
40 below. Ooh. Well, I guess that was just preparing you for the Battle of the Bulge, which we're going to hear about as well. But growing up there, you and your sister and your family in northern Wisconsin, what are the things you remember about your childhood? I imagine it's a little different from what kids experience today.
Of course, born so early, 1925, that's horse and buggy days and Model Ts. So. And very few roads that's blacktopped or something. Being up there, they was building a power dam hydro plant on the Wisconsin River. My dad was building it. And we lived out in the country where it's primitive living. There was nothing, no fancy stuff. Your car was a Model T. And you lived out in the country because the dam wasn't near towns. You was out in the woods. And it was very primitive country.
Did you have a refrigerator?
What was that?
No such thing, huh?
No such thing. No electricity.
No electricity.
No, they didn't know so far out. It was on the river. That was, they picked that spot because it was a place to back up water for a dam.
That's why he was building the dam, so yeah. Electricity could come to that area.
Yeah.
So what'd you do for lighting around the house?
At that time?
Yeah.
Lamps.
Oil lamps, huh?
Oil. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And how'd you stay warm in the winter?
Wood heat. Of course, I was only a baby, you know. I didn't know nothing about that wood heating anything.
Well, I bet you got chopping wood pretty young.
Not really. I didn't do any chopping wood. After the dam was finished, my dad, we went to lived in Rhinelander then, and he worked at the power company for that.
You moved into town once the dam was finished.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, they had electricity and lights.
A whole new world.
But we didn't have no refrigerators either.
Icebox?
Icebox. And they had a trailer that I lived in. They made ice boxes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they made ice on the river. They had a Floyd there. They made ice and put them in big buildings, stored sawdust on them to keep the ice from melting. And then they delivered it with horse and buggy, horse and wagon to houses.
Mm-hmm.
They'd chop it up in small pieces and bring it to your ice box.
A different world, to be sure. And your father had been wounded in World War One.
Yeah.
Did he ever tell you much about his service overseas?
Never said nothing.
Could you see the physical effects of his injuries, or you just knew
that was... No, he never showed him or anything. Never said nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Never talked about it.
So how did you know that he had been wounded in World War One? You saw his Purple Heart, or what?
I got his Purple Heart. He was in three campaigns. He's in the 3rd Division.
Well, and obviously, if... his injuries had been worse if he didn't make it home from World War One. You would have never been born.
Yeah.
But here you are growing up with your sister. Do you remember as that young man having some idea of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life? Did you have some ambitions like that?
Well, I come out of high school and I put in the service. From then on, I went into the electrical trade. And that's where I was for the next 44 years.
And I'm just curious, having just listened to just a few minutes of your life story here, was your interest in electrical work, did that have anything to do with that dam project and the fact that you...
Well, my dad was a line foreman at the power company. As a little kid, I grew up with all those guys he worked with. At that time, they was young men, you know? And I grew up amongst them, so I kind of fit in with them. I was the first hire they had after World War II, you know.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I knew them guys. They all knew me. And
that makes sense.
I kind of fit in.
So you said as soon as you turned 18, you joined the Army. But I'm curious about before that. If I do the math, you would have been 16 and a half when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Sure.
Where were you? How'd you find out?
I was walking downtown and come out somewhere, and I just, he's like, oh, it's a surprise.
So you were walking downtown and some people came by and were...
Yeah, there's other people. And, hey, what's going on, you know? That's a surprise. I finished high school and I went to service.
Well, how did things change at your high school or in your hometown after Pearl Harbor? Could you notice a difference?
Not really.
Were there any of the students leaving for the service right then?
Oh, yeah. Well, the guys was already going into the 32nd Division that had the company there. All the guys that belonged to it was gone, leaving. Of course, they went to South Pacific.
Yeah, the Red Arrow Division.
Yeah.
They went to New Guinea and the Philippines.
Yeah, 32nd.
And I'm sure you knew some of those guys pretty well.
Oh, sure. I knew a lot of them.
And this may or may not be applicable, but I'm just thinking about some of the other stories I've heard from so many veterans in a situation like that where you're not old enough to go yet, unless you lie about your age and trick somebody. Were there situations while you're still in school, but you're hearing about someone from your hometown who'd been killed or wounded overseas?
Oh, yeah. I knew some of them. And a fellow by the name of Macris, the veterans post was named after him. He was the first guy killed.
Yeah, if you were to visit Rhineland or Wisconsin today, you'd find the Dahlberg Macris Post 7 of the American Legion, named for Abner Dahlberg, who was killed in World War I, and Peter Macris, who was a year ahead of Roger in high school there. Peter Macris was aboard the USS Houston, a light cruiser which was sunk by the Japanese in the Battle of Sunda Strait in the early morning hours of March 1, 1942. Of the more than 1,000 men aboard, only 368 survived, only to be captured and taken to Japanese prison camps. 77 of them died in captivity, and the world never knew what really happened to the Houston and her crew until after the war when those prisoners were liberated. Peter Macris was one of those who was lost in the battle, the first from Rhinelander, Wisconsin, to be killed in World War II.
And I do a lot of guys that was killed, too.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a 16, 17-year-old kid, and you find out, hey, this guy that I was seeing in the hall at school every day just got killed in this war.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would make me want to sign up.
Well, everybody else was. Hey, I'm going to go too. Everybody else is going.
And what was the motivation there? Because I've heard a lot of veterans discuss this, and I don't know if it's something that in our day and age is easy for everyone to identify. I don't know if the same kind of spirit or sentiment exists in our country. Can you help us understand why that was so important to you to go out there and fight for our country?
Well, it's a kind of a foolish thing to say, but you're just a dumb kid. That's a funny thing. It was going to go. I had no qualms about it. I went to the service. It didn't bother me going to the service. I didn't find no problems with being in the service, training and all that stuff. Kind of thought it was a little foolish at times, but I went into service with there's four of us, and we was all in our serial numbers in rotation. The last two numbers was in the 30s. Mine was 34, and our name in rotation. I'm the only one left alive. They all died from old age.
Yeah, they made it through the war.
Yeah, but they made it through the war, too.
You know, you just shared about your feelings and why you wanted to be in the service and everyone else was doing it. But how did your mom and dad feel about you enlisting?
It wasn't too pleased, though. No, they didn't think too highly of it. But my guy's going to have to go. He's going to go. That's it. And, of course, I didn't think much of it, you know. So I went to service, put the time in, and I come home. And early in the morning, before daylight, it's my uniform. I got to sneak home, you know. I stepped up to get off this train, and there's my mother and dad smiling at me. I was going to sneak home.
You thought you'd pull a fast one on him, huh?
But the newspaper was publishing when the guys was coming home, and I think they was meeting the train a few days before, waiting for me.
Oh, you think that wasn't the first time they were there?
I think so. They didn't say nothing.
So what did that feel like when you got off the train after everything you'd been through and you see them standing there?
Oh, God. You say, oh, geez, now what? But they was happy, proud of me. It didn't mean much to me, you know. I'm home.
But you could see what it meant to them.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why your emotions are getting stirred right now a little bit.
Yeah.
I can tell. Sure. Well, and just another question. I'm sorry if any of my questions seem a little odd. In reference to so many other vets I've talked to, a lot of guys, if they didn't wait to be drafted, one of the reasons they enlisted was they wanted to go in the Marine Corps or in the Navy, or maybe they wanted to fly. But you signed up for the regular Army.
Yeah, I went into the regular Army.
Why was that your choice? What was it about the Army that you said, hey, I want to be a part of that?
Well, I didn't want to go on no airship. I want to go. And the Marines, they're glorified infantry.
And you were fine with regular infantry?
Yeah. No, oh. That's good enough for me. I wasn't afraid of the service.
Just thinking again about the uniqueness of your story, with your father having served in the infantry in World War I, did he have any advice for you before you went off to boot camp?
No, he didn't say a word. He's hoping I'd get into something else, like driving a truck or something.
Uh-huh.
One day, I think the guys interviewed me and said, well, here's the dumb kid who was sent him in the infantry.
Well, what was your welcome to the Army like? Was it what you expected when you went to your basic training?
Yeah, and after I got there a couple of weeks, I could see what they're... The idea was to train you, to they could maneuver you around, and they would treat you kind of poorly, you know. They had all kinds of reasons to make life miserable for you. But I thought, I'd learn to keep your mouth shut and stay out of sight.
Where did they send you for your training?
It's outside of Little Rock, Arkansas.
All right.
Sorry country. That's where I got introduced to chiggers.
Ooh.
Bugs around your waist that bite on you.
Well, and I guess I should ask, too, and I'm sorry I'm bouncing around time-wise here, but growing up in northern Wisconsin, there's a lot of hunting that happens there, partly just to survive. You've got to feed yourself.
I did a lot of it.
So you were a pretty good shot when you went in the Army.
Oh, yeah, I shot a lot of deer.
Uh-huh.
Partridges and ducks. I was introduced to shooting when I was pretty small. Yeah, just did a lot of shooting. I had a pretty good shot. And, of course, I didn't have to buy the ammunition. It was an M1 rifle. I didn't mind shooting it.
A little better weapon than what you were using back home, huh?
Oh, yeah.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas and meeting the enemy in combat?
Well, they had no experience. They put me on this boat they called the Ile de France. And I thought, geez, that's a big ship. That's a big one. 2 days later, I never had such a small boat in all my life. The other guys are sick. Seasick. I didn't understand that.
And where did you land in Europe?
I landed in England, and we went across the channel. I sat several days on some old tug, old boat that's run by Indians from India. I lived on bread and water. Of course, that's their food. My unit landed on D+4.
4 days after D-Day. Pretty early on.
4 or 5 days after D-Day, yeah.
Which beach did you come into?
Omaha Beach.
Omaha Beach. So just a few days before you got there, this is one of the...
It was all over with. The landing was over with.
But I'm sure there's some evidence of what had happened there that's greeting you.
Well, it was cleaned up pretty well, you know. All there was is material we had run in. And went up, got into trucks, and where are you going? I'm going to go to the 3rd Division.
So when you came ashore at Omaha Beach, were there any sights or sounds or smells that gave you the...
It was cleaned up. It was cleaned up. The dead bodies was gone, and everything was like the normal, that it was already inland.
And you're in a rifle platoon?
Infantry rifle platoon.
So all of a sudden, you're going to be in this unit where you're depending on guys you've never met before.
Nobody knew me, and you got in soul after a while. You got just like the rest of them. You didn't really want to get real friendly with anybody because you didn't know how long they would last. That was a... hardest part of being in infantry.
Hmm.
And then you get there a long time, and you see the other fellows are gone. Then you say, when is it my turn? And you get a little nervous.
Understandably so. Over the 11 months that followed, the 30th Infantry Division would suffer over 18,000 casualties. What was the situation that would leave Roger Bain with a Purple Heart, just like his father's from World War I? And how close was he to the infamous Malmedy Massacre? We'll find out when we come back. Find photos and a short video of Roger online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Roger Bain, 94 years old. He'll turn 95 soon in Las Vegas, Nevada. He's originally from Rhinelander in northern Wisconsin, but in June of 1944, he was in Normandy, a 19-year-old infantryman with the 30th Infantry Division, assigned to I Company, 120th Infantry Regiment.
Everything was moving. That's what people don't understand. It takes so much material and things to keep infantry moving. Got to feed them, clothe them, and everything. Got to be brought up to it. If you're moving, and they got to move and keep moving and get moving. And after St. Louis, Patton broke out. Oh, that Jesus! Everything was on a move. You know?
Were you involved in the Battle of St. Louis, the breakout there?
I was on the edge of it, but I never. Our unit was in it.
Uh huh.
And of course, we was moving quite fast. We went in northern France. And you're moving all the time. And of course, you may be held up here. Another unit's going ahead, and then you come along. They started to call it leapfrogging. Units would leap through each other. And of course, we closed the gap, and then we made a mess of the German army. That was a secret. There was a circular army, and then, of course, they was trying to break out, and we was trying to stop them. And they only had small ways to go, and they tried to get all their equipment out. And the Air Force ruined them. We took Aachen. I think it was the 29th Division, or I think it was the 29th. Took Aachen, and we encircled them to cut them off. I was 19, dumb yeah. kid.
Again, none of us have lived this, so you can help us understand. From the start of your day to the end of a day, as you're moving along, and maybe you don't know where the enemy is, or maybe you do, what are some of the things that you had to be aware of or watch out for that could end your life?
Well, in your position, you're going to jump off. We call it jumping off.
Right.
We're going to attack the enemy. It could be wooded areas, could be open ground. And they say, well, where are we going to go? Which direction? What? They say, well, I see that church deep away over there, a mile or so away. We'll go towards that. So, you know, what's after you start, you know, somebody's going to get some shooting going on. Then the war starts.
And shooting could be enemy rifles and machine guns. It could also be
mortars.
Uh-huh.
Artillery fire. You've got to go through all that.
Did you deal with tree bursts?
That's the worst kind of tree bursts.
Explain that to us for someone who doesn't know what that means or hasn't experienced it.
Well, an artillery shell comes in and it hits a tree. Then the shrapnel blows up in the air and covers a big area. Or if a round hits soft ground, it's muffled a little bit. A shrapnel don't go as far. Everything is hits the ground, it goes in the ground, and explodes.
So if you're in a situation and that artillery fire is coming in, you know you're susceptible to getting hit by a shell or by a tree burst or whatever. What do you do in a situation like that?
Keep going.
Just keep going.
Yeah. When you get far enough, get close enough to the enemy, they can't shoot at you. But like I got hit with a mortar round. But you got to keep going. You don't stop. If a guy gets hit, you call a medic and keep going. You don't stop.
How many times were you wounded?
Twice, more slightly. Didn't mount up too much, I didn't think.
There's a Purple Heart on your hat over there. So the Army must have thought it was significant enough. I'm wondering if, before you got wounded, if there were some close calls that got your attention.
Oh, lots of them.
Can you give us some examples of what that was like, how you experienced it?
Well, how do you say it? A bullet comes by you, close to your ear. It cracks. You don't think it goes zing. It cracks in your ear.
You don't know it's coming until you hear the crack.
No, you hear a crack. Or shells are flying all directions. I was on my hands and knees crawling under a fence. And a whole company is out in the open there. And a machine gunner was shooting from the side of us, just shooting. He's a long ways away. And I was on my hands and knees, and a bullet hit under my nose, dug the ground up. And all I could think of was, why are you shooting at me? There's all these other guys. But, you know, stuff like that, you know. Not a lot of times they just get shot at.
Was it hard to sleep at night in light of all of that?
You're tired. I slept in the coal bins. I slept in lots of foxholes, sub-zero weather in a foxhole.
Mm-hmm.
I had to stay awake. Try to sleep a little bit, two guys in a hole. That's in Melbourne. Other times you try to dig a little hole and just kind of get behind something.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about that time period once December rolled around. But from the time you landed in June, you said they pushed you up into northern France. Did you guys go through the Netherlands, too, before you ended up in the Bulge?
Belgium, Holland.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't much going on there.
Did you get a feel for the people whose freedom you were fighting for, in addition to your own as an American?
You kind of felt sorry for them. They're a little short on food, you know. They're always glad to see you, you know. That's when you're the first ones there. They're happy to see you.
Yeah.
But then after we're going through it and the rear echelon comes through, they always ruin everything. But that's just an instrumental way of thinking. They were very pleased to see us. We get a little something to drink now and then, too.
So by the time middle of December 44 rolls around, you've already been in combat for 6 months. You're probably getting a little tired?
You're always tired. You're always moving. You're always walking. Unless you're going a long ways, they truck you.
Uh-huh.
You're always looking for some time to sleep. You're always wanting to sleep.
Do you ever wish you could just go home?
Well, I know I ain't going to go home till it's over. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
If you make it.
Did you hear from your family back home at all?
Oh, yeah. Some people wrote me. Trying to fill you in on what's going on. The whole country is on war footing, you know, and they're pretty tight. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Gasoline was 3 gallons a week or something like that. Nobody went nowhere. Food was rationed. Sugar was rationed.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. Of course, you lived off venison and rabbits.
Up in northern Wisconsin, you can do that.
Yeah.
But you're over here in Europe, and you don't know that the Battle of the Bulge is about to begin.
No.
Where were you when that happened?
I was in Aachen, Germany.
Uh-huh.
And we just gone through Aachen. Then it's over with, and we start moving into the terminal.
Where did they send you?
They sent us to Malmedy, Belgium.
If anyone's ever heard the city Malmedy, there's one reason that they know the name of that city, that one of the worst atrocities of World War II occurred there.
You heard about that, where the Germans murdered the prisoners?
Yeah.
Yeah, we went through that.
Well, let's hear about it. How did you experience this? And for people who don't know.
On the edge of it. I didn't see the body. I just, the guys had seen it. They was just shot down and frozen bodies, you know.
Yeah.
It's a German tank outfit, take no prisoners.
Yes, the Malmedy Massacre on December 17th, 1944, when German forces under Joachim Peiper executed 84 American prisoners, lining them up in a field, machine gunning them, and then going back around to see any who were still alive to finish them off. They left those bodies in the snow for others to see as they passed that crossroads. And it sounds like, Roger, you could have ended up as part of that if the timing had been a little different.
But it was a medical outfit.
When you come through Malmedy, you guys learned of what had happened there?
Yeah, we was in Malmedy It was happening. So I don't know what day it was. And we was in Melbourne for quite a while.
So you were actually there when this happened, not too far away from where it happened.
See, we was in Melbourne at night. Melbourne wasn't defended. And we come at night, and we got positions. And the funny part, we was on a hill, a steep hill looking down. I could look down towards the enemy. And they had an anti-tank cannon there. And they come at night, too, and they pointed the cannon down a dead-end street. But that's how confused it was.
Well, and I don't want to press too hard on this because I understand it's you didn't experience it firsthand, but you were really close to this where these Americans are basically just gunned down in cold blood after they've been captured by the Germans on one of these crossings in Malmedy. What kind of feelings or emotions did that stir in you and your fellow soldiers?
Well, we thought it was a hell of a thing to do, you know. We never delivered, I don't think, maybe somebody did, that burned them in cold blood like that. I never did it myself. Could have. But after we found out about it, then we got it pretty cold-blooded. Some of the guys, on the 13th, we jumped off. We had a big push. I think it was towards St. Vith or something.
Uh-huh.
And then I got hit on the 13th. Anyway, before I was hit, I seen this platoon sergeant was helping another fellow we call Slim Siebel. He was hit, and he was holding him, holding him falling, and he had a prisoner. And this prisoner was hopping through the snow. The snow was up over your knees.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what the hell's wrong with that guy? When I got closer, this platoon sergeant had a pair of combat boots around his neck. He took them off that prisoner and made him go barefoot through the snow. And they got to the medics anyway.
Oof.
Then later that day, I got hit.
Well, tell me about that. Where were you? What happened?
You want the whole story?
Of course I want the whole story.
Well, we jumped off. We met the servants, and there was shooting going on. And I had a BAR shooting it.
Right.
Stopped. Jammed. And there I am with a jammed gun. The company commander was laying there. The medic was working on him. And so I go to help. He was bad hit. He looked pretty bad to me.
The company commander?
Yeah. I helped take him, haul him back on the litter. And then I went back up for three or four other guys with me. And we drawed mortar fire. And so these other guys laid down, but I stood up. I got hit. So I went back. We went 3 days. We fought for 3 days. I was in the hospital, and I talked to some guys. He said, our company's wiped out. Oh, I said, oh, bad. Pretty bad, he says. All he was left of one platoon was a platoon guide.
Wow.
A lot of guys. All I knew everybody was. Very few guys left.
Well, that brings up a lot of questions for me. One, just so everybody understands the situation here. So you've got this BAR, this Browning automatic rifle. The whole point is you've got a little more firepower than the guys with the regular rifle. You can get more shots off more quickly.
Yeah, 20 rounds a clip.
But then when it jams, it's no use to you at all.
Yeah, well, now I got to stop, see what caused it.
Right. So you're defenseless, really.
Yeah.
And you see your company commander's hurt, so you need to help evacuate him.
Yeah.
And then you come back up, and the mortar shells are coming in, and you see the guys that are taking cover lying down?
No, they was pushed on past me.
Uh-huh. But you stayed on your feet?
Yeah, I was on my feet till got the guy back, the captain back. I don't know I never did find out if he ever lived. I had doubts that he lived.
Your company commander?
Yeah.
Do you remember his name?
No, he was the new company commander. Other Captain Shaw was got hit and he was gone. This guy just come up.
And that was the nature of this kind of combat, as you underscored earlier.
I never even knew his name.
Wow. And so then you're coming back up there and a mortar shell comes in. And how close did it hit to where you were standing?
Oh, God, I don't know. It was very far away.
And where did the shrapnel hit you?
In the leg.
So did you feel it?
No. Oh, it knocked the leg out from underneath me, but it didn't hurt. The medic was with me, and I said, I think I hit, Doc. He said, can you stand on it? I said, yeah. He said, it ain't broke. Hauled me back to the station, passed me up. He went back.
So once they took you to the aid station?
It's all in the dark.
All in the dark.
Yeah, it's like I sat in a chair till the ambulance came, and they put me in the ambulance, and Well, it got stiff. I couldn't bend it. And a bunch of other guys in it. Got to the field hospital. And I got to a hospital at Liege, I think it was. And then buzz bombs was coming over. And it made a lot of racket. And all the people in the hospital all quivering, scared, you know, they listened. Because as soon as it stopped running, it would fall. Didn't bother me at all. Let it go. I'm laughing at these people so scared. Oh, Jesus, all shook up. They ain't going to hit me anyway. I can hear it.
Yeah, as long as it's still going, it's not going to hit you. Were you in any kind of pain?
No. The first hospital I got to, all they looked at it and gave me a shot.
All right.
Typhus, I imagine. Then I went to the hospital. They dug it out. Then I went to feel recovered, and I went back.
But while you're away in the hospital, your unit, your platoon, continues to fight for three more days.
Two after I was on the first day, 3 days.
So for two more days, they're in combat, and you find out later.
I was in the hospital and asked questions about the guys.
And they told you almost everyone's gone.
They're pretty well wiped out, killed and wounded.
How hard was that to hear?
Well, pretty bad when you hear the guys that you know, that you like to know.
Yeah. And did it register then, or has it in all these years since, that that wound in your leg might have saved your life?
It might stay in a way. I was out of an accident for 6-8 weeks. I don't know how long. Then I was back up, went back to my same unit. And I went to the same unit, all strangers. Just a couple guys I knew that come back too, you know.
So 6 to 8 weeks off the lines during the Battle of the Bulge, when these brutal winter conditions are also challenging. How much have you learned since about what your company, your regiment, your division went through for that time where you were recovering?
Well, yeah, they crossed the Rhine River. After the Rhine River, I come back to them. And then we went through Germany to Magdeburg, Germany, where we met the Russians.
It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come with soon-to-be 95-year-old Roger Bain of Las Vegas, Nevada. He said he was wounded twice, and we've only heard about one. What else did he see in World War II in Europe? And what was it like to go on an honor flight to Washington, D.C.? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Purple Heart recipient Roger Bain of Las Vegas, Nevada, a native of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. He survived World War II in Europe with the 30th Infantry Division. Now, I believe when I asked you earlier how many times you were wounded, you said 2 times.
Yeah.
So what was the other one?
Just a minor, just a little scratch, I call it. Didn't draw much blood.
Well, and that's the thing. And I've talked to a lot of guys, and they take the same approach. They don't want to draw attention to it or make a big deal. But a minor scratch to you is probably pretty significant to a lot of people listening.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, some guys got banged up and patched. Did go to just went to the medics and get a little patch on. And then after the war, then they said, well, for this and that, you get so many points towards going home.
Right.
Guy said, I should have turned this in.
Yeah, and I've had a lot of guys share that one of the reasons they didn't turn some things in is because they knew how much worse others had it.
That's true.
And you probably saw a lot of that.
Yeah, I don't want to deprive. I say deprive other guys of more attention.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with over there?
I don't know. Well, what can you say? You're 20 years old. Every day goes by. You're always looking for something. Something to eat, or you know, find a figure way to scratch some extra food. I think if we had to count all the sea ration cans that was thrown out and over France, it'd be a hell of a pile. You can see where we went.
Mm-hmm.
rations and K rations.
And you grew up in northern Wisconsin, which is plenty of cold and plenty of snow.
Yeah.
But what perspective did that give you on the weather during the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, I knew it. So I had two pair of stockings on, two pair of pants, two field jackets, and I had gloves on. I knew how to keep myself warm. Oh, I was cold a lot of times. You know, you're standing or laying in a foxhole days at a time. Every day, you're never inside. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, you get inside.
Would you say it was about the same as northern Wisconsin, or was it worse?
I don't think it's any worse. We had 40-degree weather up there, too, you know.
Yeah, 40 below. But the deer and the rabbits and the partridges never shot back at you?
No, never shot back. I got hit once with a shotgun. The shot guy shot me with a shotgun.
You mean back home in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I was hunting. He seen a rabbit. I didn't, I guess he said. he shot at the rabbit. Saw it hit me. Did not bad. Stung.
I imagine so.
Northern Wisconsin is, we're up in the woods. It's all woods. It was a logging country. It's like wilderness country.
So if you're in the Ardennes Forest, it's not all that different.
No. You go into Germany, we go to wooded areas. I know what that was like. And the Belgians had lots of woods. We had lots of woods. It didn't bother me.
Well, a couple other things that come to mind. You know, there are a couple things that you went through that for anybody in peacetime America, it's one thing, but you experienced in a very different situation. And I'm thinking about Christmas 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge. That must have felt a little different than a Christmas back home. You remember anything about that Christmas?
Yeah, we had bombers come over, bombed us.
German bombers dropped a few presents for you?
No, American bombers.
Your own bombers.
Yeah, medium bombers.
Because you were so close to the German lines.
It was in Melbourne. I think they made a mistake. Why don't you ask me about New Year's?
Yeah, I want to hear about that too, but tell me about Christmas. So American bombers are dropping bombs at your position.
They damaged the tower a little bit.
But they didn't kill any of your guys?
I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
Because I was on this hill and this steep bank going down, and a bomb lifted the bottom of that hill. And I was looking up at him. And I could see this thing go by. My eyes, bomb went off down the bottom of the hill.
Wow.
And I was like right back into my foxhole.
I'm sure I'd do the same thing. When it's Christmas Day and you're half a world away from home, freezing your tail off in combat, do you think of your mom and dad and your sister back home, or what occupies your mind?
Well, it's cold, miserable. I can't think of anything we got to eat special. Nothing special.
Mm-hmm. But you said ask me about New Year's. What happened there?
Big fiasco. New Year's Eve, we went on a patrol. Bright moonlight night. Two platoon sergeants were scouts, platoon sergeants for next. Then there was me up in the front. Then I finds out that we got to take, they took 40 men, picked the men out of the company. Well, I says, it'll be a pretty good thing here. And a section of light machine guns. I says, wait a minute, what's going on? I said, well, we're going to go on a raiding party. We're going to back some sort of, come several miles back and pick up some German officer, they said. Oh, that ain't bad. And they said, well, yeah, we're bringing out some litter bearers along, too. Ho-ho, I says, this is going to get kind of bad. So off we went, dark, into moonlight. And we was going along, and we got stopped. I laid down in the snow, and some German shot, his rifle went off right in my ear. I says, holy crap. And I kind of edged back, then the snow went under my field jacket. And two guides come back, we're looking for him. I couldn't see him. Oh, where the hell is he? I think he got up and run, hid, took off. Okay, so I started out again. We come to a hedgerow there, and four of us got across, and two Germans come walking up the trail. And a friend of mine, a couple of guys, they called halt, and they turn around and runs. So two guys run after to capture them. They've got to take them back. They've got them so they go back.
Right.
But they got away. So we went a little ways, and two guys says, get late. And the enemy says, you take that BR and run off a few rounds. And I said, oh, no. Oh, yeah. The guy said, well, this is getting too late.
And you said no because you would have been making yourself a target.
No, you're making a lot of noise.
Uh-huh.
I wanted peace and quiet. No, I said, I ain't going to shoot. And they said, yeah, I guess you're right. The lead turned around and everybody turned around behind it. Didn't, they went out back first and they just looped around and got back at daylight. The only shot was fired where I was. And they said, well, tomorrow night we're going out again. Oh, I says, God, this is terrible. Snowstorm come up and the big snowflakes come down and they called it off.
And you weren't disappointed one bit?
Not one bit.
So when you're talking about the German firing right next to you, so, I mean, he was close enough that he could have killed you if he saw you?
If he was shooting at me or somebody behind me, he didn't hit nobody.
Uh-huh. But he was awfully close.
Yeah, he's right there. I mean, he was close, and I couldn't, I was kind of down low, and I couldn't see him. And, of course, it's wooded.
Yeah. I mean, just hearing you describe it, it sounds like a situation where every nerve in your body is on edge.
Oh, yeah. I said, where in the hell is he, you know? What a fiasco that was.
Sounds like you were fortunate to come back alive from that.
Oh, yeah. 13 days later, the war really took place then.
Well, the other day I was curious about, just because of the uniqueness of where you were and how you experienced it, come April of 45, the end of the war is getting close, but you had your birthday over there.
Just another day.
Did you even recognize when your birthday came around?
I don't think I ever recognized my birthday.
Those things don't matter quite as much when it's life and death.
You didn't have no calendar.
You know, I'm curious, when you describe that patrol and some of these other situations you're in, was there something that you look back on now, you say, I survived because of this, or I was able to handle it and endure what I went through because of XYZ? Were there some things that helped you get through it?
Yeah, I think it's luck. It's all luck. I had so many close calls that, like in Germany, I was taking this town, this long, narrow town. It took us a couple of days to take it. I went upstairs in this brick house, and this nice glass cupboard. And I looked at it, and I said, shall I smash it? I said, no, it's a pretty nice piece of furniture. But any time this guy looked out the window down the street, looked down the street, and he went downstairs. And I left, and I just stepped in the other room, and that German tanker see that, the guy looked out the window, and he shot that into that building where that nice cupboard was. Blew it across the room and smashed it all to pieces. And that just that second, I stepped into the other room.
Wow.
Missed me. If I'd been sitting there looking at that, it'd done me in.
And I'm looking at some pictures of some people who wouldn't have been born if you had lingered.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at another picture, a wedding picture of you and your wife, Grace. Did you meet before the war, during the war, or after the war?
After the war. A friend of mine got married to her sister, and I stood up for him, and I met her. Hi, kid. Oh, I'd say, didn't mean nothing to me. I had lots of other things to do. You know, a guy, here I am with a brand new 1947 Chevrolet 5-passenger coupe, red, with everything on it.
Ooh.
Hell of a price. $1,465. I was cruising, man. Anyway, I forgot about her. Two other guys and I stepped out the tavern door. Grace was just right there walking by. Hi there, I says. I said to the guys, I want to walk this girl home. She'd lived blocks away from where I lived. That's where we took up together after that. But if she wouldn't have been there, I'd never met her.
How about that? You had 63 years of marriage with her and three kids and your grandkids. So you chalking that one up to luck, too?
Yeah, it's all luck. Here I am, putting her 95. I got a great-granddaughter going to college in California. Here I am.
Hey, what about VE Day? When you heard the Germans had surrendered, was that a big deal? Did that mean something to you?
Well, I'm glad it's over with. We could quit.
Yeah.
Of course, then we went into police action. You know, we went all spread out and went, I think I went to Rotary, Germany. And that's the first time we lowered the flag. Our company, and I and this Sergeant Strasburg, we folded the flag when it come down. That's the first time in my life ever done that. Kind of got to me.
What it represented?
But I was just a kid. But it kind of got to me at the time. Mm-hmm. Never thought much of it. But we hung out down there. We went into Camp Lucky Strike's Tent City, took a little boat across the channel to England.
That whole time you were over there fighting? this German army. Were you ever aware of the concentration camps and the conditions that, these Jews and other political prisoners?
Oh, yeah, I seen the people. I never got into the camps, but I was seen the people.
You saw some of those who'd been liberated?
Yeah.
What did they look like?
Pretty sorry-looking people.
You could tell they'd been starving?
Oh, yeah, it was nothing but skin and bones. Three, four of us guys took a train back of displaced persons. Mm-hmm. That's all. Put them in boxcars into France.
So that gave you a picture of the impact of what you'd done over there.
Yeah, how you could treat people the way they did.
Well, what was it like to come home again, to get back from the war? You told me about your parents surprising you.
Well, I want to tell you about my trip home.
Well, let's hear it.
Come back on the Queen Mary. Big deal, you know.
Deluxe accommodations?
Yeah, deluxe by a foot. 15,000 of us on it. And I was in the middle of the ocean, and word came out that the Japanese surrendered. We was relieved, because we knew if the Japs were going to keep fighting, that's where we was going to go.
Yeah. So was there a little celebration with 15,000 on that ship?
No, when I hit the harbors, was a celebration.
Did you come into New York or where?
Yeah, New York. Come past the Liberty.
What was that like, to see that statue and think about what it represented?
Pretty good. Felt pretty good to get home. Oh, you're going to have steak. What a sorry steak. Thinner and thin. And I picked it up with a fork and looked at it, and I folded it up and threw it in the garbage. I went and got ice cream. Yeah, that's the sorriest steak I've ever seen in my life.
Was it difficult, was it challenging to get used to life as a civilian again after the way you'd been living for all that time?
Well, I come home, ain't good. My mother, he's a great cook, she's cooking me all the time. I come out, the government pays $20 a week for 52 weeks. We call it the 52 Club. So I joined that, went down to the tavern and played whiskey tonk with the guys. We'd mortgage the first drink, see who paid for it. That went on for a couple of weeks. I says, I gotta go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work.
You weren't the 5220, you were the 220, huh?
5220, and I got 2 or 3 weeks of it. I went to work.
And you spent your entire career in that business, huh?
Yeah, 44 years in the trade. I worked everything from telephone booths to atomic energy plants. I was, of course, just sword to secrecy and all that stuff. I was Q-cleared, and I could go anywhere I wanted.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for helping us understand a little bit of it. I know that you had an experience more recently with Honor Flight of Southern Nevada. You and your daughter, who lives down the street, got to go with a bunch of other veterans to Washington, D.C., to see the World War II Memorial and other sites there. What was that like? What did you get out of it?
Quite an experience. We all had to go in wheelchairs, see?
Mm-hmm.
So it comes to the First World War Memorial. It was off to the side. I got out of a wheelchair and walked up some steps, and I walked over to be in the center. I could look right down on the Washington Monument and everything.
Yeah.
Lake, that. Right there, I could see another guy marched back and forth, the guard.
Oh, at Arlington National Cemetery, man?
Yeah. I watched him spit and polish, boy. I tell you, he'd march back and forth, make the turns. Then he changed the guard for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant came out and he says, I want complete silence. All the people. Nothing was said. Well, I thought of my dad. That's a memorial for him, you know. But it was fun. And of course, I'm standing there. And here come two people standing each side of me. They come with our people that are taking care of us. Standing each side of me. So I wouldn't fall. But I was in pretty good shape at the time.
But the emotions that you're feeling right now, thinking back on that moment at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, you were feeling those emotions then?
Yeah, for my dad.
And that your dad could have been the unknown soldier. You could have been the unknown soldier.
Yeah. But he was, you know, those fellows, you know, we had a lot of them too, you know, a lot of men.
Well, yeah.
Battle of the Wilds, I think 16,000 men was killed.
Well, and in the whole war, 406,000 Americans. And I don't want to suggest anything or put thoughts in your head, but I'm just curious if during that time at the World War II Memorial, when you realize that that wall there is honoring 406,000 guys like you who didn't get to come home.
Yeah.
Do you think about some of the men that you knew who were killed in action?
Yeah. I think of a lot. I remember a few names, too.
And is there any thought of that could have been me? Or why wasn't it me?
Oh, yeah. I wasn't at that exact spot. Your luck. Yeah, your bullets fly by, you hit trees and that, you see them, but you keep on going. You're just a dumb kid.
So with that honor flight experience, what was the most meaningful part of all of it for you?
Just to see that place. It's something that you don't realize, you know, how big it is, that memorial. You got treated so well. Police car in the front, the police behind us, sirens going. 28 miles of sirens, pushing that traffic aside. Cops pushed them cars aside. I sat in the front of the bus, got a perfect seat.
Well, they only do that for really important people.
Yeah, we felt like the president. When you see the president going, well, that's just like we did.
Most of the people listening to this weren't alive during World War II. Mm-hmm. What do you think we need to know? What needs to be remembered about you and all those other Americans who won that war?
We're all common, ordinary guys, you know. Every guy was in the service, volunteered or drafted, they went in with mm-hmm. no problems. They give up a lot of stuff. Common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill fellows, you know, young. They're never going to be end of wars. There'll always be wars. And there'll always be the common, ordinary guy that takes it as it always, you know. He's going to be the one that gets hurt.
When you think back on it, almost 95 years old now, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
To make it through, I guess. Take it as it comes, you know. I raised stock cars, a 38 Ford Coupe, and I had a 42 Mercury Coupe. I rolled one over and rolled it over and landed on the wheels and got stayed right in the race.
Now that sounds like luck.
That was luck.
And all kidding aside with that, again, not wanting to suggest something that isn't there, but when you say that your survival in World War II, you're meeting your wife, all these things, that it amounts to luck.
Luck is all it is.
So there's no thought on your mind, hey, somebody or something was protecting me in that situation?
I think so, yes. I believe good Lord is looking after me. At the same time, I call it luck.
You just understand it could have been a lot different.
Hell yeah. I could have made a misstep somewhere.
Aren't we glad he didn't. Roger Bain, 94 years old of Las Vegas, Nevada. Big thanks to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting me to Roger. Speaking of Honor Flight, you may have heard the news that in light of the coronavirus pandemic, all Honor Flights across the country have been suspended until at least April 30th. I hope you'll remember to continue supporting those groups. There are still so many deserving veterans who have not yet had the chance that Roger had to visit their memorials in Washington, D.C. You'll find photos and a short video of Roger online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But we're out of time on the radio today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.